Once again, Torah Club has some key insights into this passage. Paul introduced the God of Israel as one such unknown deity as his introduction, and then went on to speak of God's transcendence and self-sufficiency. Such exalted concepts of deity were already well known in the Platonic schools of thought, so it was a small leap for Paul to ask them to make. He went on to argue for natural revelation, that God had revealed himself through the created order. He illustrated these points with two quotations from Greek religious literature, both of them odes to Zeus. So Paul's language, "For in him we live and move and have our being," and "we are his offspring," are quotes from pagan literature. The first is from Epimenides the Cretan, who lived about 600 BCE. It reads, "They fashioned a tomb for thee, O holy and high one. The Cretans, always liars, evil beasts, idle bellies. But thou art not dead, thou livest and abidest forever. For in thee we live and move and have our being." The second is from Aratus, who lived about 310 BCE. He writes, "Let us begin with Zeus. Never, O men, let us leave him unmentioned. All the ways are full of Zeus, and all the marketplaces of human being. The sea is full of him, so are the harbors. In every way we have all to do with Zeus, for we are truly his offspring." Paul actually uses Epimenides' quotation again in Titus chapter 1 and verse 12. Again, Torah Club states, he went on to declare that the natural revelation of God and the fact that human beings are God's offspring both argue against idolatry and polytheism. Here again, he was preaching to the choir. The Greek schools had largely rejected the polytheism of classical Greek religion, at least on a philosophical level, if not in actual practice. Only when he began to declare a coming day of judgment, the need for repentance, all evidenced by the resurrection of a man from the dead, did he step outside the lines of classical Greek thought. They sneered at the claim of the resurrection. So Paul takes idolatrous pagan literature and concepts and uses them to help point people to the one true God. Paul has another run-in with idolaters in Acts chapter 19 when he enters the city of Ephesus. About that time, there occurred no small disturbance concerning the way, for a man named Demetrius, a silversmith, who made silver shrines of Artemis, was bringing no little business to the craftsmen. These he gathered together with workmen of similar trades and said, "Men, you know that our prosperity depends upon this business. You see and hear, not only in Ephesus, but in almost all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away a considerable number of people, saying that gods made with hands are no gods at all. Not only is there danger that this trade of ours fall into disrepute, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis be regarded as worthless, and that she, whom all of Asia and the world worship, will even be dethroned from her magnificence." When they heard this, they were filled with rage, and they began crying out, saying, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." The city was filled with the confusion. Here Paul causes a disturbance because he speaks against idol worship, calling them no gods at all. This is what then causes the local idol manufacturer to become nervous, and thus he starts an uproar in the town. He is both upset about his business and the disrespect this is causing to the goddess Artemis. Eventually, this causes such an uproar that the city clerk, who would be equivalent to the city mayor, had to step in and calm the situation down. We learn a little later on that it was believed in Ephesus that the images of the goddess Artemis had fallen from heaven. Scholars suggest that these images were actually cut from meteorites that had fallen to the earth. Therefore, there is some truth to the belief, but this is just speculation. Indeed, idolatry was such a huge issue in Ephesus that the Apostle John, writing from Ephesus itself, would urge believers, "Little children, guard yourselves from idols." At any rate, we see the tension that the belief in Messiah caused as Gentiles would turn from idolatry and thus forsake their idols. It was no small matter in the eyes of both the Jewish and pagan world. Turning now to the letters of Paul and the rest of the apostolic writings, we find the apostle having to deal with very practical situations, as many non-Jewish new believers are turning to Messiah, and yet still living in a heavily pagan environment. How would they keep themselves free from idolatry in such tainted surroundings? One of the biggest issues was food sacrificed to idols. Paul addresses this in detail in 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and verses 1 through 13. This is a long passage, but for the sake of our discussion here, it is important that we read the entire section. Now concerning things sacrificed to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge makes arrogant, but love edifies. If anyone supposes that he knows anything, he has not yet known as he ought to know. But if anyone loves God, he is known by him. Therefore, concerning the eating of things sacrificed to idols, we know that there is no such thing as an idol in the world, and that there is no God but one. For even if they are so-called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, as indeed there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is but one God, the Father, from whom are all things, and we exist for him, and one Lord, Yeshua the Messiah, by whom are all things, and we exist through him. However, not all men have this knowledge, but some, being accustomed to the idol until now, eat food as if it were sacrificed to an idol, and their conscience, being weak, is defiled. But food will not commend us to God. We are neither the worse if we do not eat, nor the better if we do eat. But take care that this liberty of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. For if someone sees you, who have knowledge, dining in an idol's temple, will not his conscience, if he is weak, be strengthened to eat things sacrificed to idols? For through your knowledge he who is weak is ruined, the brother for whose sake Messiah died. And so, by sinning against the brethren and wounding their conscience when it is weak, you sin against Messiah. Therefore, if food causes my brother to stumble, I will never eat meat again, so that I will not cause my brother to stumble. It is commonly thought that the weak here are other Jewish or Gentile believers who choose to keep higher standards of kosher by not eating food sacrificed to idols. And what Paul is saying is that even though it's not a big deal to eat food sacrificed to idols, one shouldn't around these weak brothers and sisters in Messiah in order not to offend them. While it might be tempting to interpret this passage in this light, there is a serious issue with this exegesis. As we learned earlier, one of the major prohibitions of the Jerusalem Council to the new Gentile converts was to refrain from eating food that was tainted with idolatry. So if Paul is saying that it is okay to eat food sacrificed to idols, he is undermining the authority of the Jerusalem Council in which he himself participated. Furthermore, eating food contaminated with idols is such an important prohibition that it is brought up again in the book of Revelation. In chapter 2 and verse 14, it is referred to as the teachings of Balaam. And in verse 20, we read, "But I have this against you, that you tolerate the woman Jezebel, who calls herself a prophetess, and she teaches and leads my bondservants astray, so that they commit acts of immorality and eat things sacrificed to idols." It is also spoken against in early church literature, such as in the Didache and in Justin Martyr's dialogue with Trypho the Jew. No less influential characters in the early church, such as Clement of Alexandria, Irenaeus, Tertullian, and the 5th century church father Augustine, also spoke strongly against the eating of food sacrificed to idols.